An excellent illustration of how medical science and science in general continuously questions and evaluates accepted practices and ideas is exemplified by a study on cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, recently published in the journal Circulation, Journal of the American Heart Association. The results demonstrate that people have better chances to survive when more chest compressions are used. And I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Jim Christensen, clinical professor in the Emergency Medicine Faculty at the University of British Columbia and Vice President of Medical Programs for the BC Ambulance Service. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Barry.
My first question is, what is the standard of care today with respect to applying CPR, and how have you seen it change over the years?
That's a very interesting question. I'm not sure that I can give you the exact details, because we do know that the application of CPR is still extremely variable. So there are guidelines that are written, and the last ones were revised in 2005 by the American Heart Association and a European Resuscitation Council. And there were significant changes made at that time, and they have been applied over various periods of time since then to many organizations, but we don't really know in general whether they've all been completely adopted. But I would say in general, most organizations have, and the teaching organizations, for instance, for public CPR have adopted those recommendations and are actively teaching to the new standards. The group that did this study, called the Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium, is a large organization of researchers and EMS agencies in 11 major geographic regions in North America. And within the ROC, as we call it, we've paid a huge amount of attention to trying to ensure that we are applying in those agencies the best possible CPR as a background to the other trials that we want to do to try to investigate better ways to resuscitate people from sudden death.
Now, for our listeners to understand the process of CPR, in terms of the physiological effects it has, what is it doing during the resuscitation effort? What makes CPR work?
CPR fundamentally is a technique to move blood in a patient whose heart has stopped, and so the blood is just stagnant. It's not moving at all. And I'm sure, as all your listeners know, we need blood with oxygen and nutrients to flow to our brain and to our heart and to all of our other organs to remain active. It's demonstrated by the fact that when your heart stops suddenly, it's within a few seconds you actually become unconscious and fall down. And if you don't have some sort of resuscitation within the first 5 to 10 minutes, the outcome basically is death for sure. But we can recover people if we do the right thing. So CPR, not very often does it actually save the person and bring them back to a beating heart, but it allows the heart, it allows blood flow to those vital organs, so it allows time for professional rescuers to come, or the professional rescuers themselves, as in this study, to do very good CPR, to allow them then to apply the techniques like a shock that you might see on TV in somebody who has a cardiac arrest. That would be the treatment for a particular type of rhythm. And doing the CPR makes it more likely that that is going to be a successful treatment, because you've been delivering blood with oxygen to the vital organs.
What was the basic science then that led you to look at and develop this particular study? What was it in the outcomes, or were there something that was standing out in the outcomes that said, you know, let's look at chest compressions versus trying to respirate at the same time? Where did the idea come that maybe something should have to change to provide a better outcome?
Well, we had been thinking about this and suspecting, and in fact the guidelines that were changed promoted doing chest compressions with the fewest number of pauses possible in 2005. But that was done with very little science. There was some animal data, and there wasn't really the ability to evaluate if that, in fact, was true in people. So in the Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium, we started with a few agencies that had the ability to actually analyze the tracings from the heart when the paramedics or first responding firefighters got to the patient, and look in more detail about how that actual CPR was performed. And we're continuing along that line of inquiry. And this is the first real study that has been able to look at the quality of CPR. So CPR is important, and we strongly believe that the quality of CPR is makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And we believe that not stopping CPR or continuing it to be continuous without pausing in the chest compressions is an extremely important part of that. But that had never really been proven mm-hmm. because it was impossible to do. Now we have this database of these cases that had a significant number for the first time of cases where we could actually look at the tracing. And we can not only see the electrical activity, so we can see what the heart's electrical rhythm is underneath it. For instance, is it a rhythm that would respond to a shock? But we can also see the movements of the chest wall that change the electrical characteristics mm-hmm. of the chest. So we can see every time somebody pumped down in the chest, and we can see when they stopped pumping. And unfortunately, there are many reasons why people think they should stop pumping on the chest to check a pulse, see how the patient's doing, maybe do something with the airway to give them oxygen, all of these things that seem to be kind of useful, but we wanted to see if it was in fact true that the less you stopped, the more likely the patient was to survive.
And what were the results that you found after looking at all this data?
Well, it was what we expected, and it was quite remarkable. So that what we tried to do was say, okay, there's a whole bunch of patients here, over 500 patients who have these high-quality tracings very early on when the first responders and the paramedics got there. They were all patients who had this shockable rhythm. So they had a thing that we know how to treat by shocking it, mm-hmm. and we wanted to see if the CPR that was around that shocking really was important. And call it the, sort of the dance of CPR and the defibrillation is very important. They're very tightly woven and relate to the outcome of patients. So we looked at all of those cases, and in the first minute or two up to the point when we were shocking the patient, and we said, okay, if you pause a lot or you pause a little, does that make a difference in the outcome? Mm-hmm. So we divided them into five groups, those that had 0 to 20% of the time we were actually doing chest compressions prior to shock, and then 20 to 40, 40 to 60, 60 to 80, and 80 to 100 percent of the time, so almost continuous at the top mm-hmm. end. And we found, first of all, that the chance of getting a pulse back in the patient, which does not always mean the patient's going to survive to after they're in hospital and get out of the hospital alive with a reasonable outcome. But in the lowest group, we could get a pulse back in about 58%, and in the highest groups, that rose up all the way to 79%. Wow. So almost 80% of the time, if you did really good, almost continuous compressions, we could get a pulse back in the patient. And then we also looked at not just that, but will the patient survive? And that changed from 12% in the lowest group, where there were lots of pauses, to 29% in the group that was the highest, actually had between 60 to 80%, which mm-hmm. is still very high, 29%. So from 12% to 29% chance of actually leaving the hospital alive, and the vast majority of those patients actually have good quality of life when they leave the hospital.
So I guess there's a question that I had, and I think the listeners might have too. It just in terms of you have someone, and it might be just in terms of how the CPR is done, when someone is continuously compressing the chest, in terms of being able to oxygenate that person's blood, is there a point where you do have to introduce some oxygen source or at least something into the bloodstream, or is just the chest compressions alone, if you do that continuously, that can still provide that benefit?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question. We don't really know the answer to that. It's one of the lines of inquiry, we call it, with the Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium that we'd like to do a study on to see if, in fact, how much ventilation we need mm-hmm. to provide. We know that you need to have oxygen. There has been one fairly large human study where they have put oxygen on the face of a patient but just done chest compressions. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to show, it was a before and after study, so not a real high-quality clinical controlled randomized trial.
Right.
But it seemed to show that patients got better if they just focused on chest compressions. But we need to do more work to actually prove that. And one of the reasons that it might work is is that when you actually have your heart suddenly stops beating and you fall, your blood has oxygen in it at that point. Your blood is not actually using up the oxygen. So for a couple of minutes after there, moving that blood around probably doesn't require there to be any actual ventilations. And we also know that if you put oxygen on the patient, or even if just air in a bystander situation, doing those chest compressions, there usually is some air movement that comes in and out of the lungs as well. So there's some ventilation going on in that time. And then the other flip side of it is that we know that if you ventilate too much, that that actually impedes the effectiveness of the chest compressions. Because it's kind of complex, but the more you squeeze air into the chest, it doesn't allow blood to come in and out of the chest as much when you're doing the chest compressions. So we're searching for the best balance. We know that we overventilate, and so in most of these cases, patients were having ventilations done at according to the standards. So some of them were pausing and giving two ventilations every 30 chest compressions, for instance. Mm-hmm. Sometimes some services continue the chest compressions and still ventilate at about 10 times per minute. So in this case, we weren't just evaluating chest compressions. We were evaluating when we're doing ventilations according to some standard processes. We just wanted to know if you stop the chest compressions too often, is that harmful? And the answer is yes.
And from this information, you mentioned one area you want to look at with regards to ventilation as a future study. What other questions now do you have that you'd like to formulate and apply to further research?
Well, one of the studies that we're involved in right now, actually, is just how long should we do good quality CPR before we do the first analysis and shock? So there's been some preliminary studies that demonstrate we shouldn't just shock right away, which is what we always thought we should do. But should we shock right away, or should we wait and do a couple of minutes of really good CPR and then shock? And so that's ongoing right now. We're very interested in some devices that might help blood flow during CPR, and we're investigating one now. And we're trying to look at, we have more data now than what this study showed, more patients that have this kind of data, and we're now spending a lot of time breaking it down to see when the pauses are most damaging. So is a pause that comes early in the process as damaging as one that is a pause that's just before the defibrillation? Mm-hmm. Or when we defibrillate, should we be starting to compress the chest immediately afterwards rather than waiting to see if the heart comes around and checking for pulses? Is it important at that point to actually keep compressing until we've given the heart a chance to actually not only recover its rhythm, but also recover some of its function? So the details about when the pauses are most dangerous, we're trying to look at as well. And we've had lots of ideas. There's so much to investigate. There's so much we don't know. And what is really exciting about this to me is we're not talking about fancy drugs and really fancy techniques for the most part. We're talking about things that are really basic, that this message to bystanders, that we've always known that bystander CPR really makes a difference in survival and you should start doing it. Now we can say, you know, we have good evidence that the chest compressions are really so important. Just keep on doing that. And if you forget how to ventilate or you don't want to do mouth-to-mouth because of some infectious disease issue, that doesn't mean you shouldn't do CPR. Keep pressing on the chest because it's really important. And we're hoping to be able to define in more detailed ways just exactly what the best CPR is. So not just the pauses, when the pauses are, but how deep should you press, how often should you ventilate, as we talked about. So do you come right off the chest? So some of those very, very basic things are going to be extremely important.
And is this present study, the chest compression study, is this now... Is the information and the results robust enough to apply now to change the recommendations with regards to focusing on chest compressions?
Well, I don't think that it'll result in a change in the guidelines. There'll be a new guidelines conference coming up next year, and I'm sure that this will be important information for that. The guidelines have already made the statement that it is important not to pause unnecessarily. the next step is that we did here was to say, okay, well, that was kind of a general consensus, but there was no proof. Now we have some pretty solid proof. So we can be a little bit more aggressive at saying, perhaps you shouldn't try to, if you want to put an advanced tube into the lungs so you can ventilate the patient if in an advanced care paramedic situation, maybe you shouldn't do that if you're going to have to pause chest compressions to do it. It might not be a bad thing if you can do it while chest compressions are going on, but still in many situations, it's thought to be really important. Many paramedics and many physicians think that capturing that airway in that way is important, but it's not as important as the chest compressions. So it will change the general philosophy and actually promote this pressing and pausing as little as possible, even more so. When we find the more details about when the pauses are very detrimental, it will provide more details to those guidelines about starting immediately after the shock, for instance. It is even possible with new technology that in the future we could be talking about chest compressing right through the shock because the machines don't pose a danger to the survivor. I'm not advocating that for your listeners right now, just so everybody knows, but that's the kinds of thinking that we're trying, innovative thinking that we're trying to put into this and say, how do we, now we have more solid evidence that it is so important, how do we really maximize it now?
Dr. Jim Christensen is clinical professor in the Emergency Medicine Faculty at the University of British Columbia and Vice President of Medical Programs for the BC Ambulance Service. And Dr. Christensen, I'd like to thank you very much for providing first a good background about CPR, but also really illustrating how you can break down the procedure, look at what we're doing, determine what the best practice is, apply the new knowledge to potential changes in guidelines later on, and just illustrating for our listeners how we learn with ongoing evaluation as opposed to just accepting things for, you know, this being the procedure and just continuing along the same way without analyzing it and determining if there are ways to have better outcomes. And I really thank you for this ability to do that with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for the opportunity, Barry.